I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, the show for curious cooks and eaters. What's fall to you? It's closing the windows at night, it's turning on the oven again, it's wondering if you need to buy a new scarf, and if you're in our world, it's when our mailboxes get stuffed with cookbooks. Fun fact, half of all cookbooks sold are sold in the last couple months of the year, so it's when publishers just start flooding the world with new titles. And today, we want to get into a few of the cookbooks we're psyched about this season. From a masterclass in handmade pasta, to the old-time food of Appalachia, baking with an award-winning pastry chef, and a book on the incredibly diverse cooking of Houston. But first, A Love Letter to Mexico by Danny Mena. Danny Mena is a chef, a native of Mexico City, and a dude with strong opinions on how Mexican food works. Made in Mexico is his new cookbook, but you can really kind of think of it as a guide to some of the best markets and restaurants of his beloved hometown. And our friend, the New York Times food columnist Melissa Clark, talked with Danny about some of their favorite dishes from the book and of the glories of eating your way through Mexico City.
Danny, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
So for people who've never been, tell us what Mexico City's like. Tell us about the food.
So Mexico City is a pretty big, bustling city. And with that, there are so many chefs, so many little shacks, so many types of restaurants that do a myriad of food. And there's so many like styles that there's like little fondas and little restaurants that people come and go and eat quickly, and it's like homemade food. And then there's really the, you know, the best in the world and some super high-end cuisine. And then scattered throughout the whole city is just all these like little taco stands and changarros and kind of little eateries.
And if you were going to just spend one day just eating your way through it, tell us how you'd start.
Breakfast is I'm not a huge breakfast person just in general, but the breakfast in Mexico is so great. And it's an interesting thing because really Mexican breakfasts aren't really, there's like besides eggs, you can have, you know, pozole and you can have menudo and you can have all sorts of like things that are, could be also for dinner or for lunch. But breakfast is such an important meal because people's lunch is not till 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So it has to last you the whole day.
Right.
So I would start definitely with a solid breakfast. I mean, chilaquiles is one of the best ways to kind of go about it.
Oh, tell us about that.
So chilaquiles is basically fried chips that are stewed in a salsa. Uh-huh. And it can be stewed in green, red. You know, there's some black salsas and moles. And basically that's what it is. It's chips and salsa. And then you can put like a fried egg on top and then usually like a piece of steak.
Is there like a place that is that you love to go for chilaquiles if you're going to Mexico City?
There's a couple of places that I love. The one that we mentioned in the book, which I think is great, is called Chilaquilers. And it's a play on chilaquiles. Yep. And they have like 15 different types of chilaquiles. And it's kind of in this really unassuming sort of like, or kind of this main road that you don't expect a great place to be.
Right.
And it has some really spectacular chilaquiles and or chilaquilers. And then they have one that's like incredibly spicy you know, like the beautiful thing about like the way Mexicans eat is the level of spice determines the quality of the food.
Oh, interesting. So tell us about that.
So like salsas, you know, a salsa cannot be good if it's not spicy.
Okay.
It can be tasty, but if it's not spicy, like what's the point? It's like kind of like, you know, unsweet chocolate. And you know, the purpose of a salsa. So like Mexican food really isn't that spicy as a whole, but we always add salsa. We always add chilies. We always add some sort of topper that makes it very spicy. And carnitas and barbacoa and all those things are really not spicy in and of itself, but there's always a salsa that complements it. And we love spice, and so that's why the salsa has to be kind of spicy.
Yeah, that was one thing that I really loved about your book is, you know, there was this one recipe and it was the simplest, just like grilled short ribs taco, right? And it was like salt, pepper, the short ribs. And then you say, you know, that's the beauty of it, the simplicity, but then you add the condiments, you add the salsas, and then you tailor it to your tastes.
Exactly. You know, and that dish is kind of what I love about it and what we kind of talk about, because Mexican food at the end of the day, like, is almost always intended to be in as a taco. You know, there's something about, like, you know, growing up and watching my dad just for breakfast, he would have like eggs and he'd always have his tortilla and he would like cut it into a quarter and fill it in and make these mini tacos. You know what I mean?
Right,
and then you
right.
order a thing of carnitas and you comes with tortillas and you make tacos. You order a fish and you still end up kind of making tacos. And so what's really important in a taco is, like, just if you think about it like a sandwich, the bread or the tortilla, the filling, and then the salsa. And each one of those things has to be equally as strong. You're only as weak as your weakest link, you know
right,
what I mean?
Right, like, right, yep.
And so if your tortillas are really not well made, then the taco isn't good.
Right.
You know, if the salsa is not right, then your taco's not good. And the beautiful thing about this dish is what we were talking about, the short rib,
right.
is just a solid, like a good piece of meat that if it's grilled properly and if it's just, you know, that kind of umami of what steak can give you.
Yeah.
Like that combination where you just have salsa, you have a little bit of lime and the tortilla and the sweetness of the corn. It's perfect.
Oh my God, that sounds so good. Okay, so we're in Mexico City. We should be eating tacos. Can you recommend? I mean, there's probably so many places.
There's a lot of good places. You know what I mean? There's one that I like that I didn't mention in the book just because we kind of, you know, wanted to do recipes and dishes that I've done either through my life in the restaurant or just kind of at home and the ones that people can kind of recreate. So certain things like barbacoa, you can't really do properly because those are the ones that you cook it in a pit underground.
Right.
So I showed kind of in this book a version of it. But there's one type of taco that is, I think, ubiquitous to Mexico City that really doesn't show up in the book because it's tacos al pastor. And it's one of my pet peeves and one of my, you know, I mean, the thing that I love kind of is because it's so popular, everyone tries to do a version of it. And what really makes a taco al pastor, the most important thing about it, it has to be cooked on a spit.
Right.
That, you know,
yes.
It's that Lebanese influence that came into Mexico and the way that that roast and the way that it cooks is something that makes that special. So if you just add like pineapple and you add some chili to some stewed meat.
It's not the same.
It's not taco al pastor.
Right. You know? Okay, tell us about fideo seco. Did I say that right?
You did say that right. So the fideo seco, so it's interesting. Like, so Mexican food, you kind of start with always a soup. And then you end with the main course, and then you can have a dessert, which is usually like jello. And so the soup, and so they have sopa seca or sopa. So sopa seca is so if you were to have fideo seco, it means spaghetti. If you were to have it like in a soup form, you just say sopa de fideos.
Okay.
And so, but fideos is something that like, it's kind of those really thin little egg noodles. And I was a very picky eater growing up, so a lot of my, the reason why I think I'm still alive now is thanks to fideo seco and milanesa de res, but which is like a breaded cutlet. But this fideo seco is something that's really part of like Mexican culture. And it's basically a tomato sauce. You know, you have to fry the noodles first with a little bit of oil. You get them nice and toasty.
Right.
And then you put the tomato sauce on it. And then you usually put like fresh cheese and a little bit of Mexican cream on.
Oh, that sounds amazing. That's interesting about frying the noodles. You had mentioned the Lebanese influence, like with the al pastor. Is that also part of that, the frying of the noodles?
I don't know. That's something that I don't know where it actually came from, the idea, because in, like in the United States or really in Italy, you boil it and that's it.
You boil it, yeah. You don't do the frying, but I know in the Middle East
they do? Okay, yeah. So it might have been from that influence.
It sounds fantastic because, you know, we don't think of pasta in Mexico. Americans don't for the most part, but it's so part of the culture. Mexican, but unexpected.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Okay, tell us about the bakeries in Mexico City because I've heard they're insane.
So bakeries are fantastic because like desserts and sweets that you find in Mexico, typically like tres leches and flans, those are ubiquitous like from Spain all the way to like Argentina. But bakeries, the conchas, the bread, the kind of candies that we see in Mexico are very unique to Mexico. And so there's like a Pastelería La Ideal, which is in downtown Mexico City, and there's a few other ones that are just like amazing. I mean, they're huge. I mean, they're almost like a Walmart of bakeries, and they're just lined up. Wow. So because you have such a heavy breakfast and then you have a really big lunch, typically dinner is a much lighter meal. So it's like churros or like a concha, which is probably the most famous Mexican sort
right,
of
yep.
Pastry. And when you have breakfast, you always start with the pastry. So you get like a cup of coffee and then they come by with like bread service. And then you always like pick a bread or two that you want. So
and then you have your chilaquiles.
And then you have your chilaquiles, exactly. Like if that wasn't enough.
Okay. So I know this is going to be a hard question, but if you could pick one of your favorite markets in Mexico City, which one would it be?
Oh, man.
The pressure.
What is my favorite market? Can I say two?
I'll let you have two.
It's a cop-out. I'm going to go with Mercado Sonora. You know, there's one I've been going to a lot, Mercado Medellin, which is really close to where I've been, kind of has everything and has a very specific Yucatecan area, which I love Yucatecan food. But really, Mercado Sonora is the end-all, be-all. I mean, that has everything, and it is pretty
And what should we buy there? Everything.
I mean, when you go in the summer, like there's just lines and lines of like great fresh fruit. The fruit in Mexico is just spectacular. The papaya, like I'm not a huge papaya guy, but it's just so good and so sweet with a little bit of lime. Then you have your sections of like your chilies, your moles. And then right now I did like actually for the book, we did this barbecue. And so I was in the market and so I was trying to find some food and some meat, which I normally don't buy my meat in markets. But since I went to buy everything else there, and there was like, and I found some amazing cheese, and like, and of course, all these kind of, you know, there's these lines of stalls that have all these like chickens. And then you go to another stall and they all have like longaniza, which is like a type of chorizo, or they have like this thing called chicharrón prensado, which is the chicharrón, that's the pork rind.
Yeah.
They get stewed with a sauce. And then prensado means pressed, so it gets pressed down, where it's just, it becomes like congealed into this like...
Like a terrine?
Like a terrine.
Wow.
So you can slice it kind of like a terrine, like a cake. And so there's a thing called gorditas, and we actually talk about it in the book. And so gordita is like a fat masa round.
Yep.
That gets filled typically with chicharrón. And when they say chicharrón, they mean that.
They mean that chicharrón, so it's not crisp.
It's not crisp.
Because the tortilla is crisp, right?
Exactly. So, and this one gets a lot of pork fat into the tortilla, and then it gets griddled on like the comal on the flat top.
I, my mouth is seriously watering now. Well, obviously, I need to go to Mexico City and I need to bring your book with me so I know where to go.
Exactly. I mean, that's the point of the book, is kind of there's so many places to go. And so it's a small little snippet of what I believe are some great restaurants and ones that kind of influence me and that I think are doing things really nice. But it's a very big city. So there are many, many, many restaurants that are omitted that are should be on the list, just to be clear.
Well, thank you for telling us all about some of them. It was great talking to you, Danny.
Likewise, Melissa. Thank you so much.
Danny Mena is the author of Made in Mexico. And Melissa Clark, well, she is the host of our new podcast, Weeknight Kitchen. You can find Danny's recipe for brisket tacos, tacos de suadero, at splendidtable.org. Coming up...
I'll tell you the hardest single thing that I did for this book... was what one human should never do is to take spoonfuls of six different soy sauces and then do that with fish sauce right behind it. It was like a sodium flush.
That's Houston chef Chris Shepherd. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. The chef, Chris Shepherd, is someone I've admired for a long time. I first met him, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, I think, when he was in New York to receive an award. And I knew that he grew up in Oklahoma, and he had a restaurant that was supposed to be terrific in Houston called Underbelly. But I was friends with some of the chefs who were being honored with him, and you know, after the ceremony, we all went to a Chinese restaurant for some food. So we're all sitting together. The table is just covered with food, as you imagine, like a bunch of hungry chefs after a ceremony would have it. And at some point, we realized that Chris wasn't there anymore. Like, he just disappeared. And for like a solid half hour. And where's Chris? I don't know. You've seen him. Where's Chris? And then he comes back. And it turns out that he was in the kitchen, where he was talking to the cooks and learning how to make the food and trying to help them cook a few orders at the wok. And I was like, who is this guy? But his humility and how he takes inspiration from everyone really struck me, so much so that years later, I would approach him about writing a cookbook. And even after we worked on the book together, there's really still so much I don't know about him. The book is called Cook Like a Local, and I am so happy to have my friend Chris Shepherd here with me. Hey, Chef, thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, so the first thing I always tell people about you when I'm talking about you is, you know, the fact that your food, so much of your food is about the flavors of Vietnamese or Indian or these other immigrant foods in Houston. And honestly, I was a little bit skeptical of it at first. You know, because it's like, okay, we've seen this movie before, right? Big deal chef, quote unquote, discovers fish sauce. But then I found out that at your restaurant Underbelly, like the check would come to all the customers with a note that said, you know, thank you so much for coming. We'd love for you to come back. But before you do, please go visit these other places first. And you name all the noodle shops and the taquerias that taught you how to use their flavors. Was there a moment when you realized, hey, I need to do that?
This goes back to before Underbelly, really. And it was, I got approached by Lindsey Brown, who was doing PR for the city. She worked for the CVB, which is the Convention and Visitors Bureau, who wanted to put these culinary tours on. And she got a bunch of chefs together and was like, hey, Houston is becoming more and more prominent in the food scene and getting more talked about. And, you know, we want to start taking maybe people to your restaurants and things like that. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense, really. You know, you put a bunch of chefs together and they're just going to discuss more like, hey, where'd you go eat? Hey, did you try this place out yet? What about this Thai spot down here that I found? Or have you been down to this Vietnamese joint or this, you know, a Mexican restaurant that is based out of just Hidalgo? Like, have you been there? And it was like, well, why don't we just take people there instead of going to our restaurant? It's like, that's cool, but like, I want to go out. I don't want to eat at my own spot. I don't want to eat their spot. I want to experience something new. And at that point, it was like, the tours were set up to sell to tourism. And mm-hmm. what happened was that I would say 98% of it was sold to locals. And it was Houstonians wanting to know more about Houston. And I sat back and I looked at it and I was like, look, if I'm going to go on these things and talk about these ingredients and this style of food or whatever it may be, I need to know more about it myself. And so it was me going out, having conversations and starting to learn from the families that were doing these food. Mm-hmm. You know, I put the Patels into a clear example, like at London Sizzler.
This Indian restaurant.
London Sizzler. I would go in every Saturday and just order tons and tons and tons of things. And I did that for like 8 weeks. And AJ finally sat down with me at like week 3 and was like, man, what are you doing? You order way too much food. There's no way you eat it. You just take it with you. Like, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm just trying to learn. And he was like, can I sit down? I was like, yeah, let's talk. And it was having the conversation and building a relationship and a friendship that was very meaningful to me, more so than anything else. You know, and then all of a sudden his mom comes out and sits down. Then his dad comes out and sits down. Mm-hmm, and then it's like, well, you're not doing this right. You're not doing this right. Here, this is what you need to be doing. And I'm like, all right. And so it was like getting these long conversations about technique and about flavors, but more about life.
Yeah.
And so then it was, I started doing this all over the city where I'd go to these restaurants and then start working, you know, like, hey, man, can I come work in your kitchen? And they're like, no. And I was like, okay. And then the next time I come in, I'm like, hey, man, can I work in your kitchen? No. And then like the next time, same thing. Hey, man, can I? Yes, fine. Come on. And so it would be like going back and sitting there and watching and understanding flavors develop and how technique was done. But it was more than anything, it was about families. And so in families that I can call and families that I can talk to and, you know, the folks at Saigon Pagalac, if I need some help with a Vietnamese dish, and it's like, and, you know, Jacqueline's like, no, that's easy. It's this, 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 this. And it's like, okay. And then like, well, where do I find this? And she's like, hey, come on down here. We'll go out. I'll help translate. We'll learn more about this. And yeah. So I felt that when it came time to do my own thing, Underbelly was the way for me. And it was not so much about, hey, I need to prove something to myself. Because at the restaurant before, people would come in and be like, this is very New Yorker. This is, oh, this reminds me of LA, or this reminds me of Chicago. And I was like, nobody ever said this reminds me of Houston. Mm. And I took offense to that. And so that was the goal of Underbelly, was to tell the story of Houston food through the eyes of not just myself, but everybody. And yeah. to promote and to love and to cherish all of these people that are making our city what it is.
Yeah, I love that. Because like, by promoting those people and asking that your customers go visit those people too, it's like, oh, it's about sharing your success and your spotlight and your platform with the people who've inspired you. And it's really about personal relationships, right? It's not about, oh, I took these flavors from them. It's, no, they taught me and I want to share what I can with them. I want to share my attention with them and whatever success I have with them. And I love that.
It's a really bad analogy, but it really is very true. And it's, if you ever watch a car race as a pack, the horse racing, whatever it may be, you go much faster together. But once you break out on your own, you fall straight to the back. And if we can all push together and we can promote each other and we can talk about each other and we can live in a harmonious life, then we're faster and we're better. And and that was kind of the goal for me. And that's what a lot of this book is about.
So let's talk about the book itself. This is funny because I'm sure we had this conversation at one point, but it was so long ago that I forgot. So I'm going to ask you. Given all the influences, you know, it could have been a chapter on Korean flavors, a chapter on Vietnamese flavors, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. But remind me, why did you actually break it up by ingredient? So it's a chapter on rice, chapter on spices, chapter on soy.
That was something like I think you and I and Caitlin talked about a long time
ago. Caitlin, your co-writer.
Because I didn't want like, oh, well, this is apps and this is entrees and this is salads and this is pork and this is beef. Like those books are really cool, right? But I think there's so many boundaries that get crossed with these ingredients that travel the world. You know, I think the fish sauce, you can look at it's Thai, it's Vietnamese, it can be so many different things. You know, corn as a dry product can be everywhere. And when you talk about rice, it's like one of the largest grown crops in the world, and every culture uses rice. Like, it's too hard to generalize. And so it was like, let's focus on ingredients instead of, like, dishes.
Right.
It makes it a more enjoyable read.
Yeah, and it's also about how, you know, these flavors seem unique to specific places, but if you look at the ingredients, there's actually so much that totally different-seeming cuisines have in common with one another.
Yeah, there's no borders when it comes to food, really.
Was there anything that was... I feel like I was sort of shielded from this because you and Caitlin, your co-writer, put on a brave face. But was there anything that was like surprisingly hard for you about writing the book?
I'll tell you the hardest single thing that I did for this book was what one human should never do is to... sit back and take spoonfuls of six different soy sauces and then do that with fish sauce right behind it. It was like a sodium flush. I tasted 12 different high sodium things in like 30 minutes. And it's like, hoo-wee. It was so hard, you know?
Your palate is still fried.
Yeah. I don't know. It was writing recipes. It was tough, but like, it was fun. It was fun. And man, I'm so proud of it because it tells the story of who we are as people and to be able to not just look at Houston. This isn't a Houston-specific book. It is stories of Houston, but it's the stories that if you live in Milwaukee, you can do. If you live in Memphis, Tennessee, like you can find everything. Like this is our country. This is who we are as people. And to be able to go out and take this and like, man, I want to learn something about this. Well, go do it. You know, just to learn from other people and to respect and love those people and to cherish it. And it's so... It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So, thank you so much, Jeff.
Nah, man. My pleasure.
Thanks for coming in.
Of course. Thank you.
Chris Shepherd is the author, with Caitlin Golan, of Cook Like a Local, and is also the chef owner of Underbelly Hospitality in Houston. You can find his recipe for Noise Fried Rice Balls with Cucumber Salad at splendidtable.org. Joanne Chang is the James Beard Award-winning chef of Flower Bakery in Boston. Purveyors of sticky buns so good, I used to go and buy them by the dozen, put them in my car, drive them home to New York, and stash them in my freezer. And the recipe for those sticky buns was in her first cookbook, Flower. And she's back this fall with her fifth, called Pastry Love, a collection of some of her absolute favorite recipes right now, including incredible-looking updates of those sticky buns. Chef, it's so great to have you.
It's awesome to hear from you. Thank you.
So I mentioned your first book before and your bakery. You're 19 years into the game, which blew my mind because I still remember when I started hearing about this awesome new bakery in Boston. But now you have 8 locations of your bakery and a full service restaurant. And it's probably, I'm guessing, been a long time since you were in there baking every day for customers yourself. So what makes you want to write another cookbook now?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head in that because of everything that's going on now with the 8 bakeries and the restaurant, I'm no longer in the kitchen anymore. I still remember the day when I was written off the schedule, when the baking team no longer could rely on me because I was running around from bakery to bakery and I was supposed to do, part of the cookie shift. And then I ended up having to put out a fire at one of the other locations. And so I got written off the schedule. And I think that is honestly what keeps me writing books, is that I love teaching. Yeah. I love baking. I love teaching people how to bake. I love being in the kitchen. And now my role is so much more, you know, running the business, which I also love. But the opportunity to write a book gives me a reason to be back in the kitchen. It gives me a reason to continue to develop recipes and to teach people through my writing.
Yeah. That had to hurt, too, getting fired off the bakery line.
A little bit, yes. I still miss it. I still miss it a lot.
For sure, I'm sure. But you also, it's interesting because in the book, you also write that your disposition is naturally sort of shy. But
Absolutely.
Then you describe yourself as an extrovert when you bake. What does that mean?
So, you know, you could ask my husband. I mean, he'll tell you, I am naturally not meant to be in big groups. It's just tough for me. I think I'm just a shy person. You know, there are introverts and extroverts out there, and I am definitely mm-hmm. best in quiet environments, one-on-one. This is the perfect environment for me, you know, talking to you one-on-one, not thinking about many other millions of people who might be listening. And for me, though, when it comes to baking, I feel like that is like where I'm meant to be. And whatever I'm feeling in terms of not knowing how to like communicate to a big group of people, that totally disappears when I'm baking. I am so passionate about baking. I love eating baked goods, but even more, I love teaching people how to create them. There's just this incredible thrill you get when you take all of these ingredients that are really basic ingredients that most of us have in our pantries already, and you put a little this and a little that and create a little magic, and then at the end you have this incredible pastry. And I love not only enjoying that, but just that feeling of satisfaction and accomplishment.
Sure.
And so when I can be in that environment, I guess all of my shyness kind of goes away. Like I'm so excited to just show somebody else how they too can create this wonderful dessert that I'm not thinking anymore in my head about any sort of insecurity or just any shyness that I might typically have.
Yeah. It seems almost like therapeutic. You know, there are definitely recipes in this book, even just paging through it and reading the table of contents. The recipes themselves that I would describe as probably being extroverted. And I'll give you an example that I really want to know about. And I actually don't know what it is, but there's a photo right next to the table of contents, like right in the beginning of the book, that looks like a muffin, but then it's broken open and there's like this like caramel looking goo oozing out of it. Like that looks incredible. What is that?
So that is our dulce de leche brioche. And that was actually created by one of my pastry chefs who is from Mexico. And we are always encouraging our pastry chefs to create new pastries and desserts for us. And he took dulce de leche, which is basically caramelized milk and sugar. And it makes this really rich, unctuous caramel. And he filled our brioche with it and then covered it with a little bit of cinnamon sugar. And he did it just as a special for his bakery. And I fell in love with it. And I just said, Miguel, you have to teach me how to do this. And he did. And then I thought, now I want to teach the world. And it is even better than it looks. That caramel is like, it's so rich and creamy. And then the brioche is fluffy. And then there's a little bit of crunch from the cinnamon sugar on top. And
oh man,
it's hard to eat just one for sure.
You're killing me. And there's one more recipe I want to ask you about that I think comes from you personally, because you mentioned your childhood memories of Sara Lee pound cake. And
yes.
I haven't had a Sara Lee pound cake probably in literally 35 years, but I loved them so much as a kid. They were in the freezer. I remember my parents taking them out of the freezer, and they'd still be a little bit too cold, but we'd slice into them. And like I said, I haven't had one in 35 years, so it's like pure nostalgia, which now means it's the best pound cake that's ever existed. But your apple vanilla pound cake, is that better than that frozen pound cake I used to have?
You know, I'm kind of with you on the nostalgia front. I have that exact same memory. We would have ours in the freezer too. But I remember like slicing really thin pieces and putting them in the toaster until the edges got a little crispy and the whole thing just melting in my mouth. But like you, I haven't had an actual Sara Lee pound cake for probably about the same amount of time, for probably about, you know, 35, 40 years. This pound cake is definitely different. You know, traditional pound cake, it's a pound of flour, a pound of sugar, a pound of eggs. The proportions here are really different, and the procedure is different. And what the result is a lot lighter, still really velvety, but a much lighter, fluffier crumb. So I think it's been updated to today's tastes, even though this is actually a classic French recipe. But the technique is really interesting because I learned it from Francois Paillard when I worked at Paillard Patisserie. And what I love about this, he's amazing. And I learned so much with him. And what I love about this particular cake, in addition, is that not only does it have all of the flavor from the vanilla bean, but then you shingle apples on top. First of all, it makes the pound cake just look so pretty because of the shingled apples on top, but also the apple flavor just kind of infuses throughout the whole pound cake. And so when you slice it, you get a little bit of apple, a little bit of vanilla, you know, all that butter, and it's really light and fluffy, and you can still run it through the toaster and get those crispy edges.
Nice. Okay, next time I see you, we're going to have to try a slice of our classic childhood pound cake, and then we're going to try a bite of a new one.
I love that, doing a little taste-off.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you.
Joanne Chang is author of Pastry Love. You can find her recipe for sticky buns, Queen Amon, at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the pasta master Evan Funke and the world of the sfoglino. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Evan Funke is a pasta superstar in Los Angeles. And before you start coming at me with all the jokes about how people in LA don't eat carbs, what you really need to know is that he has helped make that city really a pasta pilgrimage. And a few years ago, I got to go to the restaurant where he was working at the time. I went with a chef friend of mine, and we were just blown away by, you know, how simple the food was, really, but how perfect and delicate and thin the pasta was. It wasn't about the sauces. It was really about the pasta and the technique and the craft. And afterwards, Evan took us up into his pasta-making lab. It was a quiet space. It was almost like a study. It was very warm and chill and like meditative. There were no machines and hardly any tools. And he explained to me that he makes his pasta by hand with a rolling pin. And it was so special. His book is called American Sfoglino, and it's about how he came to make pasta that way and how you can too. Evan, great to have you with us.
Lovely to be here.
So, let's start from the beginning, sure. The beginning of your pasta life anyway. And you wrote in your book that in 2007, you were at sort of a dead-end job that you weren't excited by, and you had a revelation. Hmm. And the revelation was that you wanted to learn to make pasta.
I think I wanted to do the most difficult thing that I could find.
Huh.
So I moved to Bologna, and I found myself under the instruction of a grand master, Alessandro Spisni, of La Vecchia Scuola Bolognese.
Okay, so when you went to Bologna, well, actually, let's talk about Bolognese pasta versus the pasta around the rest of Italy,
right? Yes, very different.
And people don't necessarily know that, and they don't know that about you. You know, now your reputation is national, people talk about you, and you're known as, oh my God, that incredible pasta guy in LA. But your pasta, at least from the beginning, was very specific to the style of Bologna. So what makes Bolognese pasta unique?
So the centerpiece of the Bolognese kitchen is the sfoglia. It is the mattarello, is the tagliere, the stick and the table, and the pasta maker, the sfoglina or sfoglino.
Okay, so sfoglia is?
Sfoglia is a sheet of pasta. Sfoglino or sfoglina is a sheet maker.
Okay.
So that's literally what it means in the Bolognese dialect. The majority of them are women. Actually, I would say 99.9% of them are women. So when I first showed up in Bologna, they looked at me like I had seven heads. Like, why do you want to make pasta? What are you doing here?
Yeah.
But then when they recognized my thirst for their tradition, they opened their arms to me and showed me some deeply rooted traditions that I felt necessary and a deep responsibility to pass them on to other people. And that's what this book is about. It's my origin story and the confluence of two very influential characters that define my pasta today.
So one, I assume, is the maestro, Alessandro.
Maestro Alessandro, yes.
Who's the other person?
Kozaku Kawamura.
Who's that?
So Kozaku is, he's my brother. We met in Bologna, I think, early 2008. And he was kind of like an under-the-table instructor at the school, kind of like an assistant.
Okay.
And we obviously bonded because he spoke English. I was dying to speak English to somebody because I was homesick.
Okay.
And he opened my eyes to some very kind of revolutionary and taboo thoughts. If you're asking an Italian, especially a Bolognese, about pasta. And
and he's not Italian.
He's not. He's Japanese from Tokyo.
Okay.
So we kind of struck up this brotherhood through pasta. And from there, I kind of, you know, my style is a confluence of these two people, the deeply traditional and loving body of Bolognese pasta making and the maniacal, perfection-driven technique of a Japanese craftsman.
Oh, that's so interesting.
So that it's, and there's a lot of similarities between making pasta and how I began to understand pasta.
Yeah.
The search for this equilibrium between extensibility and elasticity and finding this great balance between the two.
Okay, elasticity, I understand. What's extensibility?
Extensibility is the ability to stretch. Okay. Elasticity is the ability to bounce back. So when you find this balance within the gluten structure, you need a very delicate percentage of each. Okay. Because if it's too tight, you have too much elasticity. You'll never be able to roll it out by hand.
Okay.
With a machine, you can just slam it in there and crank it away, and it smashes it all out into a flat, you know, pancake.
Okay.
But with handmade pasta, the balance has to be there, otherwise it's nearly impossible to roll out by hand.
So I understand you have a real reverence for the Bolognese tradition, and
Indeed.
That tradition is to hand make your pasta, hand
Indeed.
Roll it. When it comes to a diner who might not know that tradition, what's the difference between that style of pasta, that hand-rolled Bolognese pasta, and something you might throw in a pasta machine and crank out?
That is a multifaceted question. honestly, it really depends on your intention.
Okay.
The difference for me of handmade pasta versus machine rolled pasta. I'm not talking about extrusion because extrusion is a completely different thing.
Right. That's like making ziti and making rigatoni.
Exactly, yep. Spaghetti and whatnot. The difference is really textural. So if you make pasta by hand, okay, and you knead the dough together, and with each kneading motion, you're folding air pockets into the dough,
okay?
So if you take this beautifully crafted ball of dough that has thousands of air pockets in it, you take that piece of dough and you put it through two metal rollers, it basically degasses.
Yeah.
Much like bread.
Squeeze it all out.
If you spend hours proofing a beautiful loaf of bread and then you smash your hand into it, it degasses the dough, right?
Yeah.
Machine rolled pasta is no different. But if you take the mozzarella, the rolling pin, and you take that same ball of dough that has the same amount of air pockets, with the mozzarella, you have the ability to spread those air pockets out. Hmm. All of those bubbles get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller.
Uh-huh.
They don't go away. You don't degas it. They just get smaller and smaller so that they're evenly distributed throughout the sfoglia.
Oh, that's crazy.
And that's the difference. So machine rolled pasta has the density of, say, pound cake.
Okay.
Whereas hand rolled pasta has the density of, say,
like
a
chiffon cake. Or, you know.
A wafer. With all those tiny little air pockets still inside. So the integrity of the structure of the air pocket hasn't changed. It's just gotten smaller.
And that's why when I ate your pasta, it was...
It bounces back.
And it was so... there was a delicacy to it, but it also gave.
Yes. Toothsome.
Yeah.
Not al dente, because al dente can only be achieved with dried pasta.
Okay.
So fresh pasta, I call it toothsome, because you can feel that texture if you're paying attention. Sometimes a bowl of pasta is just a bowl of pasta, and that's okay for people who don't want to pay attention.
Sure.
But for me, the conversation between pasta maker and guest is very important, and the information should be there if one wants it.
Yeah.
So my restaurant, my lab, are very much teaching places, if you so choose to engage in the conversation.
And if we can't come to you, we can get the book.
Yes, please get the book.
Yeah.
Please get the book and make pasta by hand. You won't be sorry. it's just, for me, making pasta by hand is very much meditative at this point. I've been doing it for 11 years and well over 30,000 sfoglia at this point. And I lose myself to the process. I'm lost in it. And it's just a beautiful process. And the same process that I put my pasta makers through at Felix mm-hmm. is in this book.
Your restaurant.
Step by step. So if you follow the steps, the worst thing that can happen is pasta.
Yeah.
You know, then it's, everything's going to be okay.
Everything's going to be all right. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Evan Funke is the author, with Katie Parla, of the gorgeous book American Sfoglino. You can find his recipe for lasagna verde bolognese at splendidtable.org. And like he says, it's a project, but it's a dish to start with if you're going to make your own pasta, because everyone loves it. It's delicious. It's beautiful. And you can hide any pasta making mistakes in it. There is probably no American regional cuisine more misunderstood than Appalachia's. I mean, a whole TV series was once even made about, you know, people eating processed food in West Virginia, and the stereotype is it's all junk food all the time. But for a lot of cooks in Appalachia, farm-to-table never came into style because it never went out of style. People are still eating from their gardens and pickling and canning and eating the way their grandparents did. And the Foxfire series of books have been documenting Appalachian stories and crafts from the 70s till today. They're just out with a revised reprint of the Foxfire Book of Appalachian Cookery, originally from 1984. TJ Smith and Cami Ahrens, the editors, are here to talk about it. Hey, all. Great to have you here.
Hey there. Hello. Thanks for having us.
All right, so TJ, let's start from the top.
Sure.
What is Foxfire?
Foxfire is a high school English writing project that evolved into something, I think, far more than anybody that took part in it could ever expect. So this is a writing project that arose from frustrations from the students' perspective, you know, not wanting to learn their Shakespeare, not wanting, you know, they don't want to write about Ethan Frome. And then, you know, the teacher's frustration with disinterested kids. And so the teacher did something that was at the time pretty revolutionary, and he simply asked, what do you want to do? What do you want to learn about? What do you want to write about? And the students responded pretty emphatically that their deepest interests were in their own lives, with their own families, their community, the traditions of their own people. And so they were challenged and charged with going out into their community, to their families, to their friends, their neighbors, and asking them questions about their lives and what it was like to be somebody living in, you know, rural Northeast Georgia in 1966. And the material they came back with was really really interesting. There was a lot more depth there than I think even the students realized when they talked to some of these folks. You know, grandparents and parents who, you know, they interact with every day, but then they've got these, you know, really deep-seated skill sets that the students may have never even seen before, you know, instrument makers, quilters, weavers. Cool. And yeah, it was really remarkable. So that they went out and conducted this work. They came back, they wrote their expository essays in class. And then they were asked another question, you know, this stuff's really good. What could we do with it? And the students decided that they wanted to make a magazine. And so in 1967, spring of 67, they put together the first Foxfire magazine. And we've been in continuous publication ever since, 53 years.
Oh, cool.
And so they grew this regional subscription base and then a national subscription base. And then in 71, E.P. Dutton said, we would like you to put together a book of your best articles. And that was how the first Foxfire book was born. So that was published in 1972. And so those books have also continued on. We've got 12 in that primary series, 12 volumes in the primary series. And then we have a number of companion books, of which one of those was the Foxfire Book of Appalachian Cookery.
Great. And so this is not just a reprinting of that book, but a revision. So Cami, what did you add or update from the original?
Sure, yeah. So when we were looking at the original cookbook, it was kind of all over the place. It had been put together pretty well, but they had so many of the same recipes just kind of repeated in slightly different versions. And while we found that a lot of those contributions were very valuable. They were also a little bit redundant. And we also thought the book wasn't very accessible to a modern day reader. And so TJ had actually sat down with Chef Sean Brock and kind of reorganized a structure. And then we proceeded to kind of fill in that structure. And it's organized kind of by place, which is more interesting because I think it connects the reader with the landscape and the homestead as well, which I think is an important component of Appalachian foodways. But we also pulled some newer recipes in as well that we thought kind of showed some of this transition from the old ways of food, if we want to call them that, to some incorporation of the modern era.
Yeah, but okay, so, but I think it's, maybe it's the first chapter. It's all about how people cooked in a fireplace before, you know, people had stoves in their homes. So, I mean, like, what do you hope this book offers for a contemporary reader? I mean, aside from the history, of course.
Well, I think that, you know, when you talk about, you know, wood-fired cooking, that's something that is gaining prevalence again in some of the better restaurants all over the nation. But I think that people are looking at creating a more intimate relationship with their food that goes beyond. I mean, we talk about, you know, where does your food come from? Is it, you know, from this farm or that farm? Is it non-GMO? All these kinds of things we talk about in relationship to how we grow food. But then I think there's also a resurgence of interest in the intimacy that we have with food as we're preparing it. And I think, you know, reintroducing people to the idea that cooking over a wood flame is something that has been around for a long time. And, you know, at our museum, we have an operating wood cook stove that we teach classes on. So these are things that are not outside the realm of possibility for a lot of folks that are still reading this book today.
Sure. And if I can just add, I think the really unique thing about this book is even though it's documenting what's, you know, typically a historic way of cooking food, a lot of the recipes are replicable on a modern stove or oven. But the beautiful thing about this book and the other Foxfire books is that it really uses oral history to kind of tie the present to the past and to, you know, share this experience that people had in the past and bring it back into the present, because food is kind of this only way that we can have a universal human experience. And I think oral history has the power to kind of remind people of a shared humanity. And I think this book does that using both oral history and food.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, one thing that seems new to someone today may in fact be just an old tradition. It may seem innovative or creative today. And if you look at what chefs are doing today, oh, they're really into fermentation. They're really into unique ways of pickling. They're really into like unique ways of preservation, how that creates new flavors. Well, there's a great example of that that's actually very traditional in leather breeches. Can you tell us what leather breeches are?
So leather breeches are dried green beans or a dried, you know, pod bean strung up and hung to dry. And then those are sort of reconstituted in stock and
fat, basically boil them or soak them until they're the consistency of leather. So the name comes from leather breeches, like your pants.
And it's a very hearty meal. It's really delicious, especially in cooler weather. And that's a very Appalachian staple. And it's wild to see those things coming back. And I think I mentioned this in the introduction too, like ramps in Whole Foods. You know, that's not something that brought the kids running from outside when, you know, grandma was making ramps. You ran the other direction. But here it is. It's, you know, showing up in Whole Foods. That's pretty remarkable.
$25 a pound.
Yeah, right. And that's a remarkable thing to see. The food of these folks is, you know, it's getting its due. There's some really interesting dynamic flavors that come from things like wild greens and ramps and those sorts of things, or pawpaws. That's another staple from the area that has not gotten a lot of attention in the past, but now it's like, oh yeah, people are making desserts with pawpaws.
Yeah, these like beautiful custardy fruit. Like you'd always think they were tropical fruit, only they grow in Appalachia.
Yeah, it's a banana mango.
Yeah, totally. It's like a banana mango that grows in the mountains. Well, this is great. And thank you guys so much for keeping this spirit alive, keeping this information and these stories alive.
Thank you.
TJ Smith is the executive director of Foxfire and editor of the new edition of the Foxfire Book of Appalachian Cookery. Cami Ahrens is the assistant curator of the Foxfire Museum and Heritage Center and the recipe editor on the book. You can find the recipe for molasses sweetbread at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. There are so many, seriously, so many great cookbooks coming out this fall. This was just a handful of the ones we're falling in love with. But go to a bookstore this month or next or all the way through the holidays and see what's coming out. And please keep them and key publishers in business. Hey, you can always find tons of great stuff at splendidtable.org. And if you don't already, check out our podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to get them. Our newest is hosted by our dear friend Melissa Clark, who you heard at the top of the show. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it's all about getting great food on your table Monday to Friday. She takes us into her kitchen and works through one terrific recipe every week. This week, it's for a terrific, quick sheet pan dinner, chicken and grapes with sherry vinegar. Subscribe to Weeknight Kitchen wherever you get your podcast. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny Lubke is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our associate producer. Chip Walton is our digital producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I am Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.